Hello, and welcome to the Museum of Science Fiction's first podcast. My name is James Shugart, and over the course of the museum's development, I'll be bringing you conversations with some of the most important people in science fiction. Today, I'm talking with Greg Baer, an award-winning science fiction author and artist, about the cultural impacts of science fiction. Greg, thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure, James.
Let's talk about the role of women in science fiction.
Well, you know, I'm heavily influenced by women writers, especially by writers like Andre Norton. C.L. Moore, Lee Brackett, all these writers, many of them had to adopt male names back in the 40s and 50s. Lee Brackett is famous because she was actually a female screenwriter in a very masculine world. She wrote for people like Howard Hawks and collaborated with people like William Faulkner. But she also mentored Ray Bradbury, along with her husband Edmund Hamilton. And that relationship led to Ray's collaborating with her on a story and then moving off on his own. And then Lee Brackett starts writing for John Wayne movies, and it just goes on and on. And eventually she ends up writing for Robert Altman for Elliot Gould's version of a Raymond Chandler novel. So all of this kind of underlies the history of women in science fiction. But if we go back to those who just wrote books, like Andre Norton, she brought up an entire generation of readers. She was one of the first young adult science fiction and fantasy writers who hit everybody right across the nose when you're 9, 10, 11 years old. She had wonderful books, and she did write really good science fiction and really good fantasy. Later on, we've got C.L. Moore, Catherine L. Moore, who was married to Henry Kuttner. Together, they collaborated on a number of stories, and some people say it's hard to tell whether or not they worked together on all stories, especially the most famous ones. But they collaborated, and C.L. Moore started off in the 30s as a very, very rich pulp writer, doing these amazingly colorful, vivid science fantasy stories, Gyrol of Jouarre, and that sort of thing. By the time we get to writers like Anne McCaffrey, they're also covering traditional territory. They're writing for young adults as well as for adults. Annie is probably most famous for her Dragonflight series, Dragon Riders, and that's been immensely influential in both film and other storytellers. Ursula Le Guin started off working as UK Le Guin in some venues, but eventually, since it was the 60s, she just went straight with Ursula K. Le Guin. Her influence on writers to this day is simply enormous. She's kind of mentored a whole generation of young women writers who look up to her, much the way that that some of us would look up to Ray Bradbury. She's a wonderful writer. She's a stylist. She's the daughter of an anthropologist, and an anthropologist's her mother is an anthropologist and a good writer, so she had a really rich heritage to work from. Today we have a whole assortment of writers, many of which have carried on in that tradition quite admirably. We have Octavia Butler, who tragically died a few years ago. She's done, for science fiction, she's brought in a lot of new talent, a lot of new blood by her influence. And then we have the Clarion Workshops, and the Clarion Workshops have been encouraging all kinds of writers, but we've seen a real influx of really fine women writers in the Clarion Workshops as well. When I taught Clarion, we brought in people like Kathy Goonan and Mary Rosenbloom and Sage Walker and just a whole group of fine writers that have gone on to write many novels. So the influence of women on science fiction is salutary because it's actually been going on for over 40 or 50 years. I think there's a reason to say that women in science fiction were treated less badly than in other areas of literature.
And let me ask you something. I want to go back on something you touched on briefly. Specifically, C.L. Moore was the example that came to mind. Did she use the name C.L. Moore to be more widely accepted? Because if people saw that name Catherine, they might be a little more skeptical of that?
Yes. Yes. There was this feeling in publishing, especially in New York, but certainly in pulp magazine publishing, that science fiction was written for boys. There were a fair number of women who were reading it, but they really considered it to be a boys' literature, and so the boys wouldn't want women writing it, and that was what led a lot of the writers to take a more masculine name.
All right, well, let's talk about some of your work. I mean, you've done a whole bunch of books, obviously. Queen of Angels comes to mind.
Yeah, Queen of Angels was my response to the whole revolution going on in the 80s involving nanotechnology. I'd started off participating in a kind of biological version of nanotechnology on my novel Blood Music, but I was quite fascinated by the notion that Eric Drexler had been putting forward about biological machines, but also silicon-based machines. making smaller and smaller things and essentially transforming the world. So Queen of Angels is an economy based on nanotechnology. My main character, Mary Choi, is by choice a body morphing type. She's changed her body to suit her profession, which is a professional cop. And so she's actually designed herself to be more suited as a cop for her world. The other aspects of Queen of Angels involve separation of rich and poor, involve the development of new entertainment industries based on what we now call the web. All of that was published in 1990.
Very good. And, you know, science fiction to a lot of people, instantly they go to TV and movies. Obviously, that's influenced it a lot. Star Trek, Star Wars, those have had some big influences on people coming up.
Especially the original Star Trek TV series, immensely influential.
Tell me about the Star Trek non-interference policy.
This actually goes back to a tradition in science fiction. There's been a lot of thought over the years about the role of observing natural phenomena without causing changes in those phenomena. The whole Heisenberg principle is kind of the metaphor behind that. In anthropology, you are not supposed to transform the societies you observe because in colonial and imperialistic days, transforming the society was the goal, not observation. You wanted to Christianize them or otherwise influence them. If you're a Muslim explorer or a Muslim military type, you'd want to convert everyone to Islam. So in the parlance of the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, we're starting to become aware of the value of diversity in cultures, and also just the sheer politeness factor. What Roddenberry did as an ex-Navy officer was take a look at all of the policies in anthropology that had been going on since 1920s at least, and decided that for the Star Trek universe, it would be the policy of the Enterprise as it explored brave new worlds, strange new worlds, to basically not mess with the cultures. Now, they had a kind of a mixed result in their efforts, but that was the goal. And so for certain types of planets, planets with life forms, et cetera, you'd either leave them alone or you'd study them very, very carefully.
And Star Wars, even people that haven't seen Star Wars or weren't really into it, they all know about the Force, you know, this idea of this mythical telekinesis power.
Right. Which I think George Lucas kind of regarded in the Andre Norton sense as a science fiction concept, not so much a mystical concept. But it sure seems mystical to me as I look back at having written a Star Wars novel and you know, felt the implications of the mythic underpinnings of that universe. When he's talking about the Force, the whole suffusion of this dark and bright side, he really is getting us back to kind of the days of Edward E. Smith, who also got sort of mystically inclined in his novel Triplanetary, where he's talking about the bright Arisians, the good godlike aliens, and the dark Edorians, the dark nasty ones. There's a little bit of that in Star Wars, a little bit of the mystical side, but from Lucas's point of view, he doesn't want it to become a religion.
Yes, very nice. And, you know, science fiction has made itself kind of a new way of accepting socially and change. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, science fiction has, and I think this goes back to nerd culture in general. In my experience, nerds just are sort of naturally less bigoted than other groups. Now, I won't say that all libertarian nerds are less bigoted, because I've encountered quite a few libertarians who have kind of fallen prey to the Southern Poverty Law Center version of libertarianism. But in the original concept, they weren't naturally bigoted. They accepted, certainly at science fiction conventions, acceptance of otherness was much more common. In the outreach of science fiction, when you get a show like Star Trek on TV showing all kinds of races working together in a future where there are no discriminatory laws, in the 1960s, that was huge. There had also been a lot of TV shows and movies that were trying to begin with that concept and move the society forward, but Star Trek showed it already in place. It showed it working. It gave people real jobs in a real future. It gave people real respect for not just blacks and Asians and other types, but for the alien. There were a lot of aliens that just showed up, and no one seemed to think differently of it. So the whole Star Trek universe involves that moment of where you're watching, you know, a control board or the bridge or whatever, and there's an alien sitting there, and it's just fine. It's not an issue. I think that's still a useful concept today. Science fiction has always wrestled with the notion of what it means to be alien, the alien within us, the alien outside of us, and the aliens that we accept, the aliens that we are.
And you know what? I'm glad you mentioned the science fiction conventions, because that's a great example of how it's still happening today. People show up to these events dressed in anything imaginable, really, and sometimes you can't even imagine what they're going to show up in, which wouldn't be accepted, you know, normally just walking down the street. And at these events, it's what you expect.
Yeah, it kind of is. We role play, we play our fantasy worlds out, but we also kind of address what we think of others when we put these costumes on. Our attitudes toward the alien, towards the fantastic, towards superheroes, towards almost the godlike powers that we see in comic books and so on. The whole notion of dress-up occurs in science fiction conventions even back in the 1930s, where Fory Akerman shows up in an outfit inspired by the movie Things to Come, with bright, wide shoulders, kind of a definite fashion statement, wings over the world. Later on, we have people who establish real reputations in costume competitions at science fiction conventions. My wife, Astrid, and her mother, Karen, were deeply involved in all of these things back in the 50s and 60s. And Astrid, in fact, was a grandmaster of costuming. Today, WorldCon is a great place to watch people walk around, but the real mecca for costuming is Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
The Comic-Con in San Diego, which I was fortunate enough to help found back in 1970, is now just a maze of people walking around in really wonderful costumes.
Mm-hmm.
So successful is that sometimes movie stars show up in their own costumes from the films and are almost considered anonymous. People admire the talent and the good look of the costume, but they don't know they're actually the real actors.
I guess it's a way to kind of hide in plain sight then.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes you don't even need a lot of makeup. There are a lot of legendary stories about that. I'm not sure which of them are true. But if you are a character in a TV show or a movie and you show up in costume, you'll fit right in.
Awesome. Thanks, Greg. And what about science fiction? You know, it's had kind of an effect on science itself in these post-war advances. Tell me about that.
Well, back in the 1940s, of course, even back in the 1930s, if you look at an editorial that John W. Campbell wrote in the November issue of Astounding, he was the editor of Astounding, but he's also a very opinionated, very informed editorial writer for his own magazine. And in November of 1939, he talked about the discovery of fission, nuclear fission. And he says, you know, there's a war coming on soon. I wonder if we will get to the end of this war without using an atomic bomb. Now, he's basing his language in part on the language of H.G. Wells in his novel The World Set Free, who described an atom bomb, an atomic bomb, in some detail. That influence actually touched Heisenberg in Germany, touched Leo Szilard and Edward Teller in the United States. That language and the concept they thought was far more accurate than what other scientists were saying about a nuclear weapon. And, of course, that leads us into the middle of the 20th century, to the end of World War II, the Cold War, and the realization that we were really getting into a dangerous time period here where two very opposed forces, the Soviet Union, the United States, the Western world, could come to loggerheads and would have the weapons to blow ourselves up. And that led to a whole rich, nasty, nightmarish genre of nuclear war fantasies and nuclear war horror stories. One of the first was a novel by Will F. Jenkins, Murray Leinster, called The Murder of the United States. I think that was 1948 or 49.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly thereafter, you had Earth Abides, and then we moved on to Alas, Babylon by Pat Frank. We moved on from that to Failsafe, and then to Dr. Strangelove, based on a Peter George concept, and eventually just, you know, it just became part of the whole landscape. Even Star Trek is post-nuclear holocaust. There's a war, I believe, in the past of the Federation. So all of that infused, certainly those of us who grew up reading science fiction in the 50s and 60s, it infused Robert Heinlein's stories, it infused my stories. My novel Eon is one of the last of the kind of nuclear apocalypse beginnings for a science fiction series. And it still touches us to this day. I'm a big fan of submarine novels and starship novels, and all of that kind of arises out of this burst of technology that came out of World War II, a lot of which was influenced by science fiction. Apparently, Wernher von Braun and a lot of the German rocket scientists got their science fiction subscriptions to Astounding and other magazines through neutral countries, but they wanted to keep reading them. So I'm wondering what von Braun thought as he's reading the Campbell editorial on whether or not a nuclear weapon will be used. And I'm wondering what, you know, those observers in Japan who first saw the explosion at Hiroshima, the Japanese observers who said that's an atomic bomb, I wonder how sophisticated they were and what they were reading. Because a lot of people were totally unprepared for it, but right. Science fiction readers weren't.
Right, and it's interesting, too, because it's kind of had this cyclical effect where as science fiction has become more popular, it's created more in the way of technology and engineering, and as a result, it's made it even more accessible to more people.
Yeah, I think it explains things to them. They don't have as much of a future shock effect if they've read science fiction or watched the movies. You know, we follow and track certain things like cell phones, flip phones, and we say, okay, that's like the Star Trek communicator. And that's true. The Star Trek communicator, though, goes back to at least to Forbidden Planet, where you had the little kind of iPad-like devices and the portable communicators and so on. If we get to the actual iPad, there's one of those in Dune, actually, the 1984 movie based on Frank Herbert's novel. They show Paul Atreides reading about Dune, Arrakis, the desert planet, on what looks like a kind of a desk-mounted iPad. So all of these things influence us. The design influences us. What books can do is they can contribute to the concept, the idea. Isaac Asimov talking about calculators and many, many people talking about central mainframe computers ruling and all that sort of stuff. Eventually, we make our choices based upon all those story scenarios, and both engineers, inventors, software engineers, all these folks can study science fiction and the reactions to science fiction for the reactions that other users might have later on if they send these products out. So it's kind of like a product testing ground. Movies do the design extremely well. I've been very impressed over the years how films give us the visual look for something. But quite often when people say that this was first shown in a film, they're wrong. It's quite often shown in a science fiction novel.
You mentioned before how science fiction can kind of warn people of bad things that could happen, but it can also provide a lot of hope for people as well.
Yeah, I think there's a combination of both. Most of the books I've written have been what I call balanced biological novels. There's both good and bad in the worlds I describe. Mm-hmm. Certainly in something like Queen of Angels or Slant or even in Blood Music, you know, you've got a positive side of all of these major changes. The changes are shocking. They're even frightening, but they can lead to a different perspective, to perhaps more a balanced life, to a more enlightened life. Science fiction does that for all of us. The dark side is balanced out by the fact that we learn from our mistakes.
Part of what makes science fiction so interesting and so popular is that it's just fun. It gives people an escape.
Yeah, let's not forget that. In all of this serious social analysis, the reason I started reading science fiction was the most fantastic, amazing kind of literature I'd ever read. Science fiction, fantasy, horror, all of these things were highly colored, highly demonstrative, highly stimulative of my imagination. And as a kid, I just adored that. I adored having my pants knocked off by reading Arthur C. Clarke, or just being charmed and frightened by reading Ray Bradbury, or, you know, putting Isaac Asimov putting me into a kind of argumentative mood. Wait, will that really work? Wow, that's incredible. Let's think about that. So all these thought problems, all these philosophical issues are presented in very, very fine storytelling such that they're easily digestible, but also very stimulating.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Greg Bear. We appreciate your time. And if people want to find out more information on you, where can they go?
Well, they can go to www.gregbear.com and leave a note.
Awesome, Greg. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, James.
That was Greg Bear on the cultural impacts of science fiction. Visit our website to learn more about Greg's work, as well as our plans to bring the Museum of Science Fiction to Washington, D.C.